When you're young and life and the world ahead of you are limitless, what do you do? That's a question to be answered individually and in another discussion. Today we'll focus on what people think when the end of life is close. Knowing that life has an end can make us appreciate life itself more, quite a bit more if we let it. Our guest this hour has visited many deathbeds and families grieving people who have died. Steve Leader is the author of The Beauty of What Remains, How Our Greatest Fear Becomes Our Greatest Gift. Steve Leader is a rabbi. He leads the large congregation at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles. Rabbi Leader is a prolific writer with sermons, essays, and books to his credit. His previous book is More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Steve Leader, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Great to be with you today.
Good to have you. I sense a bit of an overlap here, a sense in these two books of the darkness making us appreciate the light a bit more.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. You know, death is its own world, of course, and its own teacher, but it is also part of a world that involves many kinds of loss. You know, there are many kinds of death. There are many kinds of loss. There's the death of our bodies, of course, but we can have the death of a marriage, the death of a career, the death of a dream. You know, there are many, many forms of loss. And you're correct. I'm exploring them all in these two books.
You vividly remember, as you tell us in this book, your first funeral as a rabbi. How many have there been now, do you think?
More than 1,000.
Wow. Well, yeah. Wow. And talk about the sermon on the eve of Yom Kippur a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for asking. That's really the foundation of the backstory for the book. I gave a sermon 3 years ago now on the holiest night of the year for Jews called Kol Nidre. It's the eve of Yom Kippur. And it is the day devoted to repentance and seeking forgiveness. And the day itself is structured, it's almost like a Jewish Day of the Dead. It's structured to mimic death in many ways. We wear white to mimic the burial shroud. We fast because the dead neither eat nor drink. We have a number of other things layered in to really encourage and in some ways make it almost impossible for us not to contemplate our own death so that we change our lives for the better. And I gave a sermon about the 10 things I had learned about life from seeing so much death up close over 30 years. So this was 3 years ago. I gave that sermon, and 1 year later, to the day, I buried my father with my family in Minnesota after a 10-year journey through Alzheimer's. And what I learned through that experience of losing my own father, through being a participant rather than a professional observer and facilitator, really helped me understand some of the things I had gotten just a little bit wrong in that sermon. The way I put it in the prologue is that I felt after my father's death that that sermon was just 1 degree shy of the deepest truth. And so I wrote this book to try to bring everyone with me down to that 1% deeper level of the truth that death teaches us about life.
Let me ask a little more about your father and his decline. And I just, you know, you're obviously well-trained as a rabbi, many years of experience, but did the training and gifts evaporate or wobble at least when you had to talk to your father about his decline?
Mostly not. I have to say, I was grateful for the lessons I had learned from so many others who had parents go through these long declines and what I learned from them about what they did they were glad they did, what they failed to do that they wished they had, what they did they regret doing. So I actually did bring a lot of that experience with me to my father's, you know, final years. And, you know, that was a blessing. There's no question about it. So obviously, it's a different experience when it's your own father, but I learned not to wait to say the things I wanted to say to my father. I learned that in his Alzheimer's, I needed to dial into his reality, not try to pull him back into mine. You know, that wherever he was in his mind, that's where I wanted to go with him. I had learned prior to this from people who had been through it when their parents lost the ability to speak, how powerful and important touch is. You know, I would spend hours with my dad in the nursing home just holding his hand. And we in essence learned a new language toward the end of his life. I hadn't held my father's hand, you know, since I was a little boy. And it was beautiful. So I learned a lot that I did carry with me, but there were some things I thought I knew that I didn't.
Which is why this book exists, yeah. The beauty of what remains, how our greatest fear becomes our greatest gift. Explain the title a bit.
Well, the title appears many times in the book, but the basic idea is that death as a force in our lives takes things away. Theologians call this via negationis, that you can understand what something is by understanding what it is not. So imagine, for example, the most beautiful marble sculpture you've ever seen in your life, Jeffrey. And think about how that marble sculpture began. It began as a solid block of marble. And that beautiful sculpture was there all along. It was hiding in plain sight. But it took the removing of many chips by chip by chip by chip to reveal that beauty that was always there. And it's a metaphor for me for many things, not the least of which is death itself. When we have loved ones who die, when we experience a death, it takes things away. It removes. And our mission is to then appreciate and hold on to the beauty that remains. And that's where the title comes from.
And there it is, The Beauty of What Remains, How Our Greatest Fear Becomes Our Greatest Gift. It is the work of Rabbi Steve Leder from Los Angeles. We'll come back and talk more with the rabbi, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. We already have one person saying shalom. He was a busboy at the temple in Steve, when you greet dying people, they say, I'm fine, and you say they mean it.
Yes. Yes, this is one of the things that has surprised so many people about the book. I have been at the bedside of, you know, nearly 1,000 people, and I always ask, are you afraid? I always ask, because I want them to have the opportunity to talk and to pierce that isolation of fear. And every time, Jeffrey, without exception, the answer has been no. Not one person. Now, let me be clear. This is a person who is actively dying, hours, you know, or a day away from death. Now, I am also not telling you that they have no fears. They fear for the people they're leaving behind. Are the kids going to be okay? Are they going to take care of mom? Are they going to stay together? People have fear and anxiety at the end of their lives, but it's never for themselves. Never. In my experience, which I admit is anecdotal, but it's pretty large. They're ready. Disease and age, they have a way of their own rhythm. And power, and they have a way of carrying everyone along and preparing everyone for that last few moments. And I have never been with a person who was really afraid. Now, the good news of this, in all of this, is not only for the dying, but for all of us alive who are anxious and have anxiety about death. Because if you're anxious about dying, Jeffrey, I can honestly look you in the eyes and say, today is not your day. Anxiety is for... Anxiety is for the living. If you were really dying, you wouldn't be anxious. So take a breath. You're going to be okay today. And that's really true, and it's really helpful.
This is the part of the book that got me from near tears to laughing out loud, because if you're worried and anxious about dying, you're not dying. But
exactly.
As you learned this, Rabbi, did it change your approach in ministering to the dying, or perhaps more to their families?
Well, it really, families do honestly see this. It's pretty self-evident at the end that everyone is prepared for the inevitability of death and the peace and release of death. So what it has done is help me counsel people who have a profound fear of death and give them one simple, admittedly simple tool to calm their fears a little bit. And in that sense, it's been very useful.
So for those of us left behind, the people standing at the bedside who are not leaving imminently, I mean, what to do or perhaps not to do as the end approaches?
It's a really good question. If we're talking about a person who's dying who is still pretty lucid and can converse, then one of the things I suggest, because, you know, when we're at the end of life, our world shrinks to the square footage of a hospital bed or a rented hospital bed or a bedroom bed. You know, our world gets very small, and we're really bedbound. And I often encourage people to take their loved one on what I call a mental vacation. They can't travel, they can't go anywhere, but they can in their mind and their memory, and it brings them an hour of real relief and enjoyment. So I in the book, I even give people some questions they can ask. So if it were you, and I hope that's many, many, many years from now, Jeffrey, I would say, Jeffrey, tell me about your first kiss. Who was it? Where was it? When was the first time you fell in love? What was the funniest thing you ever saw? What was the greatest meal you ever had? You know, I'll take you on a journey. Tell me about your best vacation ever. And we'll go on a journey together. And that's a beautiful way to spend time with the dying. Obviously, it's really never too soon to have conversations about what the dying want in terms of funeral arrangements and what would you like said. I always ask people, is there anything you want me to be sure to say? Anything you want me to tell the kids, you know, at the funeral or everyone else who will be there. So you obviously have those kinds of conversations, but I really like taking people on a beautiful mental vacation. And the whole room, who's ever there, they all get swept up in it. And it's really pretty magical.
Steve Leader, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, our rabbi at one of the larger temples in the world, the Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles. His book is The Beauty of What Remains, How Our Greatest Fear Becomes Our Greatest Gift. You know, one of the things, too, in addition to the mental vacation, is you're urging to not be afraid to lighten up. People do have some pretty good laughs with dying loved ones, I would think.
Oh, this is such an important idea that so many people get so wrong. I'm really glad you raised it, Jeffrey. You know, when we encounter the dying or the grieving after a death, for example, you go back to a home after a funeral, so many people feel the need to put on a kind of phony, badly acted, you know, persona of sadness and deep remorse. You know, they walk in with their long faces and whispered voices. Oh, Jeffrey, I'm so sorry. So terrible. Oh, my goodness. And that is not what people need. What people need when they are grieving, or what the dying need when people are coming to be by them, is they need you to be with them in death exactly who you were with them in life. If you were a hugger, hug. If you were a feeder, feed. If you were a joker, joke. If you're a listener, listen. If you're a handholder, hold hands. People need you to be the same person they've always known and loved, because that is the only thing that reassures them the bottom isn't falling out of the world. So be who you are. Be authentic. That's what people want, and that's what people need. And again, the good news in all of that is not only that it's good for the mourners or the dying, it's good for us because we know how to be ourselves, you know. It's harder to be someone else than to be yourself. So just walk in the door and be authentic, and the rest will unfold. That's it.
How honest, though, to be, Steve, about your own fears about your future without the person who is about to die?
Well, there, I think there is some Academy Award performance required at the very end. I think even if you have your own doubts, I think it is the right thing to withhold those doubts from the dying and assure him or her that you're going to be fine. We'll be okay. We'll take care of each other. We'll take care of mom. It's all going to be okay. You did a great job. You can let go. Even if you have your own doubts, that is not the time to share them with the dying.
So the things that people tell you about their funeral wishes, I'm curious to know about the things they tell you.
Well, some of them are hilarious. Like I had one woman, you know, really pull me down to pull my ear down, you know, to her lips in her hospital bed, and she said, "Rabbi, when I die, please tell the kids no deli." So, you know, sometimes you get that. You get some funny things, but mostly you get a kind of crystallization, a distillate of what the person hopes the living will carry on. It's usually very terse and simple, beautiful, like haiku. you know, tell the kids I love them. You know, they were my life. Be kind, be good. You know, it boils down to something quite pure and beautiful.
Steve Leader, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a rabbi at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, and the author of a new book called The Beauty of What Remains, How Our Greatest Fear Becomes Our Greatest Gift. And yes, we're talking about death here on the program and how to approach it, how the approach of death helps us focus a little more on what life was like. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your questions, your comments, your stories, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And I'm glad, Steve, you pulled the curtain back a bit. This really can be hard on you. And how do you cope?
You know, I'm pausing because part of the answer is I don't really know. I don't know how I cope and hold. I literally have a funeral every day this week, except for Saturday. And that's partly because of COVID and partly because there are weeks like that when you're the senior clergy in a major congregation. And Jeffrey, to be honest, part of it is I don't know. It's my job and I do it. And I was raised that way. You know, from the book, I was raised by a very demanding, father who drove me and worked me very hard from a very young age. And, you know, if you give me a job, I'm going to do it. And so that's a part of it. And of course, you know, that creates some collateral damage internally. I'm exhausted a lot. And I don't have a better answer for you. I wish I had some deep answer for you, but really I do it because it's my calling. I think if there is anything deeper, it is that there is something within me that I can recall from when I was a very young boy. There's an empathy component in my soul. I've always been the kind of guy who runs toward a fire. Mm-hmm. I've always been a person who wants to, when he sees suffering, help other people. Sometimes, frankly, at my own emotional and physical expense. But that's who I am. And it's part of the reason I'm able to do this. So I think it's both a strong sense of empathy, and I don't know where that comes from, and a very, very strong work ethic, and that does it. But I would be lying if I told you it was easy and didn't come with its own pain and damage.
No doubt. You've described your father's brutal work ethic here and in the book as well. What about your mother? Did she give you the empathy that you carry around with you?
You know, it's interesting. The editor, when she read the final manuscript, and she really loved it. She really did, which pleased me. She said, and I kept wondering in the book, where is your mother? Where is your mother? And then in the epilogue, it all made sense. Mm-hmm. So I do kind of explain why my mother didn't play a larger role in my life toward the end of the book. I would say there were many things. First of all, neither of my parents knew anything about parenting. They had five children before they were 30. They were raised by terribly inadequate parents. They were 17 and 18 when they got married, had five children by the time they were 30, and I was the fourth of five. So they were pretty tired by the time my little brother Greg and I rolled around. She had her hands full. You know, we had a family of seven in about 1,400 square foot, two bedroom, one bathroom home. We lived a kind of blue collar existence. She didn't have help. You know, she cooked, she cleaned, she did the school lunches, the orthodontist, the dentist, the pediatrician, and all of that. And I think that was the limit for her. And that was the best she could do. And it's also true that my father kind of claimed me. I was the firstborn son.
Oh, right.
Right. And I have three older sisters and he loved them and he, you know, but there was something different about me. And my father kind of claimed me at a very young age as his project. And that's how it went in my family. I do have, you know, really nice memories of my mother, but, you know, and they also had a really, really unhappy marriage. And that makes it hard to give love, you know, when you're so unhappy in those other ways. So it's a complicated story, and I don't blame her for it a bit.
We have some listener context to share here. Anne in Grants Pass emailed to say, I hope your guest explains further that when death takes away, there is beauty left behind. When I think of all those dear beings I have lost, I seem to just get used to them no longer here, but I don't see any beauty with them not being here anymore. I have no fear of death for myself. I do feel a great loss of special ones not filling my life anymore. I know they never leave our memories, but it is very different than having them here physically. We just learn to live without them, writes Anne in Grants Pass, and she includes in her signature a line from Anatole France, until one has loved an animal, a part of one's soul remains unawakened. That again from Anne in Grants Pass.
Well, yeah, the poet called death the absence that is forever present. So perfect, the absence that is forever present. And I think that's what she's describing, in a sense, is that missing. But I can only speak from my own experience in terms of what I mean by the beauty of what remains. My relationship with my father is in some ways better after his death than it was before. Time has rounded some of the sharp edges, and I discover my father in new ways, beautiful ways, almost every day. I'm in a situation where I know exactly the Yiddish word he would use to describe it, and it makes me laugh. I know exactly what he would say to me when I feel challenged and alone and afraid. I can summon him, and it's so beautiful. And I also see him in my children, his grandchildren. I see him, the ways they remember him, the ways they are like him. So for me, there's a very rich afterlife within me. My father has a rich afterlife within me. And that's what I mean by the beauty of what remains.
So I want to ask about the red bowl in your office. It's a repository for the tissues for the people who cry, but what else?
So I keep this red bowl on the coffee table in my office in front of what I call my couch of tears, because people come there to weep. And yes, it's used to collect the tissues. But every once in a while, Jeffrey, I encounter someone who is dealing with a terribly dysfunctional relationship or person and trying their best over and over and over again to make it better. And sometimes I just have to point at that bowl and say, Jeffrey, you see that bowl? You can talk to that bowl all day, all week, all month. You can talk to that bowl for the rest of your life. You can go to therapy with that bowl and try to turn it into a spoon, but that bowl is never going to be a spoon. It's always going to be a bowl. And at a certain point, Jeffrey, you are the fool. And this is a way of helping people understand that there are a handful of relationships in most people's lives that cannot be repaired, that are toxic, and just need to be ended.
So when you're talking to people about, particularly the people who think, well, you know, maybe my father and I can have a reconciliation before he dies,
yeah.
How do you counsel those?
Well, yeah. So, you know, often people come to me and say, you know, Steve, I've had a bad relationship with my father most of my life, but he's just been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He's got 3 to 6 months. I'm going back east to visit him, and I'm sure we're going to have a really good talk, and we're going to get close. And my response is, I hope so. But my experience is that most people face death exactly the way they face life. And most people die the way they live. So I want to manage your expectations and be realistic about the fact that death doesn't give anyone a new personality.
Steve, you have some specific questions that you ask of families when you are called to a situation where somebody is really in medical distress, ER or ICU. And what is the question you usually ask of the family?
Well, you know, that's a chaotic and stressful moment for any family when they're gathered around and the physician says, we can do A or we can do B. What do you want to do? And that's often when I get called in. And I have found a single, very simple question to be the single best tool to clear away a lot of the confusion and clutter and chaos and really clarify the decision. And that question is what you are contemplating going to prolong your loved one's life, or is it going to prolong your loved one's death? Because it's the right thing to do in loving, to prolong love and life, right? If you've got a chance, let's take a feeding tube, for example, for it to go in as a bridge to a day when it comes out, mm-hmm. and you're healthy again and can love and live your life with the people you love, do it. If putting that feeding tube in is prolonging your loved one's death, never going to come out, he's never going to get better, it's going to buy us a little time and a lot of suffering, I would say it's cruel. And so are you prolonging life or are you prolonging death is a very, very helpful question in those situations. And so many people that I have shared it with have circled back to tell me how much it helped them make what they believed was the right decision.
It is a very clear question, and I can see how it would really sharpen the thinking. You go into some detail on assisted suicide and the beauty of what remains. California, of course, joined Oregon and Aiden dying a few years back. I forgot, as the chapter in your book about this started, that this is not something the Jewish faith supports. So how have you worked that out?
Well, this is one of the themes that I explore in the book, is the role stress between Rabbi Steve Leader and Steve Leader, the son, Rabbi Steve Leader and Steve Leader, the human being. The role stress of that is very difficult sometimes. Sometimes they're totally aligned, most of the time, but every once in a while, not. And when it comes to Aiden dying, they're definitionally not aligned because Jewish law is categorically opposed to active euthanasia. Categorically. It allows passive euthanasia, but it is absolutely forbidden to unnaturally hasten a person's death, no matter whether that's for a minute, an hour, a day, it's irrelevant. No matter how compromised that person, from the standpoint of Jewish law, it's irrelevant. And so here I am at the bedside. I write about this in chapter 4 of the book, I think it's the best example of this dichotomous tension between what we do and who we are. And so I was asked by a husband to come to his wife's bedside. She had told him weeks before that when she gave him the signal, she wanted him to call me and have me come over and give her permission to take the medication to end her life. He called me. I went over there. And I walked into the room. And she was dying of ALS, which is, as we all know, a horrible disease. And I don't know about you, Jeffrey, but I feel that oxygen deprivation is just such a terribly cruel way to die.
Right.
So horrible, and that's what she was enduring. And she couldn't speak, and she'd lost the ability to point to letters on a chart to spell simple words. So we couldn't have a conversation about it. It was just me looking into her eyes, and she was looking back at me. And then I stepped out into the hallway outside that bedroom with her husband and her daughter, and I said, listen, Jewish law forbids me to say yes. It is absolutely forbidden, but I'm going to go back in there, and I'm going to say yes, because I cannot live with myself being more humane to my dog than another human being. And so I walked back into the room, and I said, Tara, it's okay. Take the drugs. You have my blessing. And then I left. And as I say in the book, a couple hours later, I was home, and the phone rang, and it was her husband. And he said, Tara's gone. Rabbi, thank you so much. Rabbi, thank you. And I say, he was calling for Rabbi Leader, but it was Steve Leader who picked up the phone.
So this you had to work this out, obviously, the tension between you, the person, and you, the religious tradition. Jamie in Medford had some questions about differences in views of what comes after life, Jewish versus Christian, for example.
Yeah, well, like almost any question you ask about Judaism, there are multiple answers because it's a 3,000-year-old tradition. So there is everything in Judaism vis-a-vis the afterlife from resurrection. I mean, think for a moment about Ezekiel in the Valley of Dry Bones, right? That's resurrection, that vision of these bones coming up and taking on flesh. So it's barely hinted at in the Bible, but in later rabbinic literature, there's a very intricate concept of afterlife. It's kind of like an eternal utopian existence with time to do nothing but study sacred texts for some. And, you know, that exists in Judaism. But Judaism also was subject to the forces of enlightenment and modernity. And so then you get these ideas of, well, the transmigration of the soul. The body dies and the soul lives on. That's what I personally believe. And then you have Jews who believe that when we die and that's it. You know, we're purely corporeal beings, and when it's over, it's over. And then you have people who, as I call it, say in the book, there's a chapter called The Afterlife of Memory. There are people who believe that there's an afterlife of memory. Of course, the problem with that is at some point, there's not a person left in the world who remembers us. And does that mean that's when we die? I don't know. But there is a broad spectrum of ideas in Judaism about the afterlife.
So I want to ask about your description of the eulogy at a surfer funeral. 43 words, some of which I can't say on the radio. You didn't think it was appropriate at the time, but you had a chance to let that simmer a bit.
I did. That was such a good moment. So a young guy who was on the U.S. Surfing team died. His parents were members of the congregation, and I officiated his funeral, which was at the beach under a tent, because after that, the whole U.S. team was going to go out, do a paddle out, and create it like a daisy with their boards and say a prayer and have a little ceremony, a kind of surfer ceremony for him out on the water. So we did the ceremony right at the beach. And, you know, I did what clergy call an intake meeting with his parents, and we, you know, planned everything, and I gave what I thought was a really beautiful eulogy, but obviously it was kind of a formal eulogy. And then it was time for the captain of the U.S. team to get up and speak. And you're right, there's some language I can't use, but I'll try and do it in a way that is okay for radio. Is that okay, Jeffrey?
Yes, please.
Do that? Mm-hmm. All right, so he got up, and this was all he said, and I'm going to change the name. When I heard about Bill, I was surfing Pipeline, and I caught a huge wave, and it almost ripped my effing head off, but I caught the lip, and I tubed it. And I just want to say, it's because Bill was with me. And then he sat down. And I thought to myself, oh my God, that was awful. But then I looked up, and I saw a whole row of surfers nodding their heads and wiping tears from their ears, from their eyes. And I thought, ah, he spoke in their language. He spoke in his language. And that's when I learned, I was very young, I learned the importance of first being non-judgmental about how people grieve and how they articulate their grief. And also the importance of dialing in to the mourner's frequency, not my own. And that was a very powerful and hilarious, I have to say, lesson. My imitation was restrained this morning. Let me just put it that way.
And we appreciate that. We get to keep our license this way.
Yeah.
You talk about eulogies and encouraging a stew of stories from the family that help you pick out the things that should be said then. But I wonder how you approach the eulogies for people who were in strained relationships or had major flaws, or most of their family was angry with them when they died.
Well, I tell the truth in a sensitive and diplomatic way. First of all, we all have flaws, all of us. And I don't think we do anyone any kind of justice or honor by presenting them after they die as a two-dimensional human being. I think we really honor someone's life when we present them as the three-dimensional human beings they were. And we dishonor a family's memory of the flaws if we completely ignore them. So what I generate, first of all, I always try to get families to share the flaws with me. You know, after about 20 minutes of asking questions, and you, and everybody's laughing, and oh, he was so great, and he was so this, and he was so that, I then pause and say, you know something? So far, he sounds perfect, and no one's perfect. So what wasn't perfect? And then you see the family's eyes dart back and forth, as in, how does the rabbi know? Who told him? You know, or their eyes are darting back and forth with a kind of, can we actually talk about this? Should we? Can we? And I encourage them. And I say to them, listen, trust me to handle this diplomatically. But let's have a real conversation. And then it begins. And then it comes down to the art and the craft of being able to say things in a way that the family feels heard, but does not in any way bring dishonor to the deceased in the minds of others or the family. So, for example, today I'm doing a funeral later today for a woman who was really all up in her children's business all their lives. I mean, she was just in their business from day one, and these are grown women now, and still in their business, and it annoyed them, and it was a problem. So I'm going to say today, you can say many things about your mother, but she was never indifferent, right? Never indifferent to you or your life. And sometimes that was beautiful, and sometimes that was difficult. So I don't have to say she was a nag and a hassle and a this. You know, I said it in a way that was elegant. I'm saying it in a way that's elegant, truthful, lets these women feel heard and acknowledged, but doesn't create any kind of cruel or mean-spirited energy to the day. So, you know, there are ways to say things that are diplomatic and kind even, yet truthful about a person's flaws.
We have about a minute left, Steve, and I just want to ask about the epilogue in the book. I mean, you talk about your father and the brutal work ethic he bequeathed you, but you know, you ended up having a better life in many ways than he did. You tell us about the Talmud saying the son acquits the father, and you did. Yes. You tell us how.
Yes. Well, yes, the Talmud says that the son acquits the father, and I've always understood that to mean that all of us have parents, because they were human, who were flawed. They did their best. No one wakes up saying, I'm going to ruin my kid. All our parents did their best, but they had flaws. And the way we can redeem them of those flaws is by not repeating those flaws in our own life, not repeating that dysfunction in our own life, by being worthy of the flaws we were exposed to, by leading a more beautiful, more loving, less flawed, more noble life ourselves. And in that way, we acquit our parents from their past mistakes, no matter how large or how small. It's really about our responsibility to lead an honorable, beautiful life. That is the beauty that remains.
Wow, you've got the title in there at the end. The Beauty of What Remains, How Our Greatest Fear Becomes Our Greatest Gift. It is the work of Rabbi Steve Leder from the Wilshire Boulevard Temple, a huge synagogue in Los Angeles. Rabbi Leder, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you, Jeffrey. I appreciate it very much.